Thanks a lot for the flattering introduction, and thanks, of course, for the invitation. The way I see it on this conference, I'm the guy in charge of literature. For this reason, in my brief talk, I shall try to give a quick historical outlook on the emergence of modern insurance first, whereupon I will attempt to indicate in what respect literature takes an interest in insurance and its uncertainties. If there is anything like a geography of risks, it must have its origins in an elementary divide, in the partition between land and sea. And for this, there are two reasons. On the one hand, since the onset of Occidental seafaring, the sea has been envisioned as a field of infinite and incalculable dangers, as a lawless domain of mere contingencies, where demonic forces or unpredictable acts of God threaten man, his institutions, and cultural efforts undertaken ashore. On the other hand, precisely this domain of dangers and waywardness has provoked the emergence of what one might call the short-lived security dispositive, the emergence of insurance. To start with my main assumption, this double perspective of an imaginary and a calculative approach, which both time and again become indistinguishable, to me seems characteristic of the Occidental effort to establish security. And moreover, it seems the prime reason for writers to be interested in insurance at all. As for modern insurance itself, it actually emerged as a maritime enterprise. Historically, one has to return to the 14th century when two revolutions took place at the seaports of northern Italy. The so-called Rivoluzione Commerciale, based on the introduction of paper and the Indian Arabic ciphers, and on the invention of double entry bookkeeping. These innovations enabled the former mercante viaggiatore to stay at his office as a mercante residente and to handle his sea business via commissioners. The whole development allowed not only for commercial partnerships between merchants, ship owners, and skippers, but also for separation and cooperation between the routes of seafaring and the routines of bookkeeping. The so-called nautical revolution, in turn, concerned improvements in shipbuilding as well as the introduction of the mariner's compass and the first sea charts. Since then, ships could be en route throughout the whole year and comply with the proper timetable. Both revolutions led to a commercial takeoff, to growing investments in overseas trade, and in view of the great losses at sea in the meantime, to a huge demand for nautical safety and commercial security. Since ancient times, the bottomry bond, the so-called firmus nauticum, had served as a kind of speculative trade in maritime business. Merchants or ship owners could borrow money that, in case of shipwreck, they didn't have to pay back. Only if the business succeeded, they would have to return the credit plus an interest rate of about 30%. But during the Middle Ages, the canonical ban on usury scared the moneylenders away from sea trade. Why should they bear all of the hazard for the mere expectation of a small profit? In this situation, Italian merchants, eager to benefit from overseas trade, found a remedy in inventing the assicurazione, which effectively was held for a technical invention. They defined this business as a credit without interest, supplemented by a contract which ascertained that they would assume the sea dangers in exchange for a certain charge. This charge, the so-called premium, was to be payable in advance, whereas the credit should be disbursed only ex post, if the ship actually went down. This arrangement was approved by the church, which now being allowed for new partnerships between capital and labor, inasmuch as the transfer of dangers was made explicit. For this reason, the merchants introduced the concept and term of risco, derived from the Greek word risa, simply meaning cliff. The invention of risks supported the modern spirit of enterprise, especially in the event of maritime adventures. And by rewarding the merchants for participating on a monetary level, in the long run, it dispersed the ban on usury. Risks are dangers converted into merchandise. As such, There are specifications and numberings of what, beforehand, has been imagined as a shapeless and nameless threat. Since the emergence of risks in the maritime business, it's utterly impossible to take no risks. People, or to the later establishment of non-marine insurances, at least people involved in seafaring, either run the risk of needlessly insuring themselves, or they run the risk of not being insured, and thus being completely exposed to potential perils. For this reason, dangers no longer are threats assigned to a mysterious environment. Dangers now are threats not yet taken into account by insurance, or threats exceeding its scope, for example, acts of God totally beyond experience and expectation. In any case, the invention of risks led to a pragmatic approach towards fate, providence, and contingency. By converting dangers into risks and by trading those risks on the market, diffuse fears of loss could be turned into expected profits. Risky business thus not only distributes disadvantages, it also offers chances. As with the stock market, to which maritime business insurance has been added from the beginning, it establishes a kind of feedback link between contingent future and present action. And it deals with virtual realities, virtual values, and virtual goods. Insurance has been the precondition for the expansion of modern markets, of which it was part of from the outset. And as such, it has been the prerequisite for the type of modern governance Foucault describes as governmentality. There are two frequent misunderstandings concerning the role and operating model of insurance. Firstly, if they provide for security, this does not mean that they minimize risks. Quite on the contrary, on an epistemological level, their main task is to create new risks, so that security and risk go hand in hand. Apart from that, as a security technique, insurance in itself bears certain risks, intrinsic hazards, so to speak. Technical risks, for example, encompass the possibility that the traded risks haven't been priced properly. Evolutionary risks designate yet unknown risks emerging from natural or technical developments, so that they concern uncertainties about future uncertainties. And finally, moral or subjective risks indicate the uncertainty about the actual behavior and intentions of the insurers. Insurance fraud, in particular, is a severe menace to the security of insurance itself, even if it has been part and parcel of maritime trade from its early days. Insuring ships already lost, over-insuring ships and their cargo, or deliberately wrecking insured ships poses a threat, incalculable, and therefore utterly dangerous or even criminal. The second misunderstanding is related to the operating model of insurance. It has not evolved from wages, although people from the beginning speculated on the possibility of a shipwreck by taking out a policy. These abuses were soon banned as an assicuratio in propria. Since then, every insured had to show credibly that he takes a real interest in the insured ship or cargo. Apart from that, maritime insurance as such has nothing to do with probabilistics. Its dangers are too heterogeneous and irregular to be used for statistical data. To this day, there is no proper risk form. Maritime risks have been rated and are still rated, for example, amongst Lloyd's underwriters, by sheer experience and by mutual observation between competing insurers and their customers. Rating maritime risks is even now an uncertain and risky business. If one turns against this background to modern and early modern literature, the sea and seafaring appear to be topics mainly of allegoric instruction or later on of adventurous experience. Maritime insurance itself seems non-existent or at best marginal. There is, however, one famous play dealing with the birth of insurance out of the sea, Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice from 1600. Exactly because of the remarkable absence of insurance techniques in this drama set in the 16th century, One has to conceive it as a meditation on the risk of credit and its compensation, on overseas trade and commercial as well as amatory adventure. If the royal merchant Antonia had insured his ships, he would not be in the danger of his creditor, the Chu Chai. But precisely this anachronistic intrigue permits Shakespeare to set on stage the early modern soldiers of fortune, their daring challenges of fortuna, their modes of being and behaving, their practices of trust and distrust, of promise and obligation. The play was written just after England had entered into overseas trade, whereupon its credit economy expanded and taking interest was legalized. Shylock, in short, acts as a pioneer of modern capitalism. Though he appears utterly merciless as a money lender, he deals with money, time, and credit risks exactly as proper banks do in Shakespeare's times. This unlucky usurer embodies the crisis connected with England's entrance into risky business. The need for new contracts and legal rules, as far as risky partnerships are concerned, is exemplified by Shylock's complex court case. And finally, his judge Porcher acts as Fortuna in person, since it is she who manipulates communication and who informs about the fate of Antonia's ships. To sum up, Shakespeare's play allows for monitoring risky business in its rules of conduct, its speech acts like that of promise and bond, and its long or short-term effects on partnership. Not seas and ships, but officers and merchants are put on stage. Be it merely for technical reasons, going offshore has been an exception in theatre. Whereas in epics, ships and shipwrecks have been a topos since Homer. But as a problem of insurance, shipwrecks did not become a central subject in sea tales before the 20th century. What could be of any interest here for a narrative anyhow? To attempt an answer, I'd like to throw a glance at Joseph Conrad's story, The Partner, published in 1910. To summarize the plot, very quickly, in a seaport's hotel, the first person narrated, a professional writer, comes across a grumbling stevedore who tells him about a shipwreck from 20 years prior, whose remains still are a tourist attraction. Two brothers, Aridanda, a dutiful sea captain, and George, a former clerk, invested their inheritance in a sailing vessel, the Sagamore. Clute, a Dutch projector, so to speak, becomes George's partner and convinces him of investing in a lucrative drugs patent trade. For this, the Dunbars should sell the ship. Unthinkable as this seems for Captain Harry, who identifies with his ship, Clute conspires with George. If they wrecked the vessel secretly, the insurance sum would furnish the necessary capital. Clute engages a potential wrecker, the broke outcast and former seaman, Stafford. But George later refuses the manipulation, whether from lack of nerve or a bad conscience. And after Stafford shows up again and again to supply for him, he's made chief officer of the Sagamore. One day, the wreckage near the coast was reported. Clute gets on board, regards the disaster as a mere accident, refuses to pay Stafford, and locks him into the captain's cabin while the vessel is still going down. To pick up the ship's papers before disembarking, Harry, the captain, returns to his cabin where he is shot by a panicking Stafford. Officially, Harry has committed suicide out of despair, and Stafford is forced to testify that the wreck was a mere accident. But half of the insurance sum goes to Harry's widow, thereby George includes misparticipating in the quite profitable patent trade. So for the plot, just to be known about what I'm talking about. Striking in Conrad's tale is its narrative construction. A writer looking for material is told the story by a nameless stevedore who was informed by the Dunbars and the notorious Clute, and who, in addition, constantly rants about the silly yarns of tourist guides, of newspapers, and professional writers. At the same time, he promises the truth, a truth beyond picturesque sea life on board, beyond seascape atmospheres and sublime sights of wrecked ships. This truth is presentable merely within, quote, a remote connection, and its only imaginable stage is George Steinberg's business models. If there's any occurrence the truth revolves around, it is the insured event and its fraudulent enactment, or rather, encampment. One could say that Conrad's tale inverts the business-like conversion of daily narratives into account book entries, as prescribed in the early modern treatises for bookkeeping. The story is, in a sense, deduced from an invoice item. And one could suggest that the tales within a tale examine the occurrence of a shipwreck in a similar fashion as the English Shipwreck Committee was commissioned to do it at the time. The partner explores the fictitious and fraudulent aspects of risky partnerships, such as those between the Dunbar brothers, between George and Clute, and between the Dunbars and the insurers. In this perspective, the conventional means of verifying the insured event turn out to be futile, be it the prima facie evidence, be it the reconstruction of shipwreck's causality. Mind you that Arthur Stafford has managed, quote, to monkey with one of the cables without leaving any proper link, quote end, in the anchor chain, this link in the accident's causal chain remains undetected. Thus, Conrad's narrators turn to the crucial element in the verification of insurance claims, distinguishing events from their observation and narration. Insurance isn't confronted with proper facts and doubtless propositions. Rather, it has to deal with contingencies, namely with events that could happen or could have not happened. And it is exposed to speech acts that could be truthful as well as fraudulent. The security insurance offers is entangled with uncertainty. On these insecure grounds, examining an insured event calls for a second-order observation. Not assume facts, but rather their outer and inner circumstances have to be observed. Outer circumstances encompass the when, the where, and how of what happened, whereas inner circumstances comprise the witnesses and interested parties, their reports, their arguments, their intentions, and their reliability. Thus, not anything like the factual world, but its observation is being observed. The course of this observation must, of course, be infinite unless one abstains from proper truth and contents oneself with a certain appearance of truth. Veritas is not the goal, but rather its simile, verisimilitude. And what is called narratio verisimilis in terms of rhetoric is nothing but a circumstantial narration, considering inner as well as outer circumstances. In contrast to dramatic plays, narratives are apt to present inner perspective and experience. As in Conrad's tale, fictionality, the narrative observation of cognition and consciousness, is not merely fiction and not merely the opposite of truth. On the one hand, it may deconstruct any certainty about assumed facts and causes of events. On the other hand, even if it doesn't provide certainty, it may lead to a willing suspension of disbelief. Everything depends on the narrators and their mode of narration. Turning back to Conrad's tale, dutiful and faithful Captain Harry, a prototype adventurer on board, would be a reliable narrator, but he is just as mute as his antagonist, Stafford, a former now disgraced captain who has become a criminal. George is Harry's counterpart insofar as he is a mere mercantile resident and an adventurer on shore, an adherent to a venture, one could say, a pioneer not of danger, but of risk. He and his statements are linked to his partner Clute, quote, a man who's been in the patent medicine trade and who thus will be up to anything from pitch and toss to willful murder, quote end. Conrad's narrator is thus informed by a narrator who in turn has been informed by two fraudulent and unreliable narrators. The interest Conrad's first-person narrator takes in the story does not concern its truth or noteworthiness. He instead uses the shipwreck and insurance story as an exercise in another kind of certainty, an exercise in fidelity and faithfulness. Fidelity, Conrad writes in A Personal Record, fidelity to a person or fidelity to an object is perhaps the most ancient non-pragmatic rule in human relations. By non-pragmatic, I mean not following from practical considerations of gain or success. Faithfulness, in turn, is a great restraint, the strongest bond laid upon the self-will of men and ships on this globe of land and sea. Quote end. Fidelity and faithfulness both are aesthetic as well as ethical qualities. And moreover, both seem inextricably linked to the proper exercise of seafaring. For Conrad, maybe the most famous author of modern sea tales, the ship and its command, just like an ancient allegory, is, quote, a moral symbol of our life. It's a symbol for the faithful art of writing, but also a symbol for concerted action, or, as one could say, for proper governmentality. There may be a rule of conduct, Conrad says, but there is no rule of human fellowship. To deal with men is as fine an art as it is to deal with ships. Both men and ships, living in an unstable element, are subject to subtle and powerful influences. Quote end. Under these premises, Conrad Sereda is the eloquent advocate of the mute captain, and Conrad, the writer, is the faithful partner of Conrad, the former sea captain. To conclude, notwithstanding their undisputed modernity, Conrad's sea tales side with an original, namely nautical experience of danger, and they resist the culture of security together with its intrinsic uncertainties, its usury of fictions and virtual values. Conrad opposes the faithful craftsmanship on sailing ships to the speculations, the manipulations and frauds inseparable from modern sea trade, from modern trading risks. And if the skeptical view of insurance in its fictions leads to the fictional praise of seaborne experience, he finally fortifies what risky business has since then deregulated, the elementary divide between land and sea. And maybe this is the final paradox of Conrad's contradictory modernity. Its faithfulness and certainty is rooted in the sea, within the lawless domain of mere contingencies. Thanks for that.